Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to On the Continent, your one-stop shop for all things to do with European football. I'm Dotun Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Miguel Delaney.
The focus is back on La Liga as Real Madrid make an audacious bid for PSG's Mbappe. But is it enough? And what are the unforetold consequences? Also, the Jose Mourinho roadshow is back on track in Italy's Serie A, as was written in The Stars. Who is the special one in his Roma team? And from the Champions League, a 2021 rerun of the 1988 European Cup final is a timely reminder of how far football has come. But first, to the ongoing saga, it seems, this week at least, of Kylian Mbappe. Will he go or will he stay? He wants to go, but will he stay? Miguel Delaney.
This depends on who you talk to. From people who have worked with Mbappe, I was actually surprised by this when the news broke of the bid on Tuesday night, but they are insistent that this will happen this summer. I mean, even when I put it to them that this is surely Madrid posturing as Leonardo so very kind of conspicuously made a point of saying that it's just Perez showing how much he wants him. They do believe it will happen this August. But let's see, I suppose, much of that is dependent on the I suppose, greater level of commitment that Madrid show and whether they'll actually match what Paris Saint-Germain wants. Although, I mean, speaking from outside that, I do think it may given it's certain that he's going to leave, probably for free, if there's no deal agreed, 160 million euro feels like the sort of deal that Paris Saint-Germain should be taking up.
It felt like if there was one club in the world that could and would say no to that,
yeah,
it would be Paris Saint-Germain. But things have changed from the fact that they realise that he really means it now. He's not just posturing. He does want to go. And if you're really wanting to mend fences, you don't use the sort of language that Nasser Al-Khelaifi used, the president of Paris Saint-Germain, on the day that they announced they were signing Messi, where he said, look, Kylian's got everything he wants now. He said for us to build a team around him, and we've done it. Now, whether we want to take our critical eyes out and go, well, you know, maybe you haven't got too many players impressing that. It's interesting the sense that's coming out of Paris that Messi arriving in Paris has made Mbappe want to stay less.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it knocks him down in terms of hierarchy. It can't help but do that because this had become his name, his team. I mean, he was happy to leave Neymar as the name above the door, but realistically,
yeah,
he knew it was his team, and he knew it was his team from the moment when that they brought Neymar back from his extended injury break in the start of the 2018-19 season. It was meant to be Neymar's night at the Parc des Princes. He did that wave to the fans and all the rest of it. Kylian Mbappe, not even playing, comes onto the pitch in his civvies. What's this in the pocket of my leather jacket? Oh, it's the World Cup.
Of course.
And, you know, when you've got a guy who's like a hometown hero and, you know, doesn't need to show off to say that he's going to be the best player in the world. That was a changing of the balance of things at Paris Saint-Germain. And now it's changed a little bit. It's got to be the Messi show. So I think there are a lot of reasons why Mbappe should go next summer. One, because if he's free, there's more money for him. Mm. There's no doubt about that. Also, it gives Real Madrid an extra year to construct a good team around him, and it gives them the money to construct more of a team around him. And we know they haven't got a bottomless pit at the moment. And he gets to play with Messi and Neymar for a year. On the other hand, that's what Real Madrid are a little bit worried about. You may think this makes no financial sense for them to do it now, but I don't think it's about opening up the field to competition. You know, the thought that maybe a Liverpool swoops in or anything like that. I don't think they're particularly worried about that. The thing they would be worried about is Paris. What if he really enjoys playing with Messi and Neymar?
Well, also, I think there's another side to that as well. I mean, now one of the reasons people say Madrid have no money now is because of this stadium. And, you know, by all accounts, it's drastically over budget.
Mm.
But there's also a flip side to that in that now throughout the kind of the Galactico model under Perez always been that basically these signings pay for themselves because of the amount of commercial buzz around them and what they do for the profile of the team. And I think that's a stretch for a lot of their signings. But in the case of Mbappe, and particularly at this point in history where La Liga has no stars and Madrid basically have no stars apart from Hazard waddling around at this point, I think it's especially true for Mbappe. And I mean, what strikes me here is that Madrid have they suddenly have this, they've refurbished the stadium, but at the moment, no real stars to fill it, to attract people. Whereas they sign Mbappe now, it just changes the whole feel around the club. And kind of restores that buzz, makes Madrid a real kind of an elite destination again. I think it's why actually it makes financial sense, for, and especially if, I mean, given the financial history of these things, where basically there are a few banks that will say no to Madrid or to Perez in Spain. But for this one, it feels like opening a credit line for this feels actually, there's a logic to it because it is a signing that has a kind of a multiplying effect for the club as a whole.
And he's only 22.
Yeah, which exactly.
You're talking about getting 10 years of Mbappe,
yeah,
which is massively different to, like buying Hazard,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah, yeah.
You see what you're both saying? You're both essentially saying that he's more likely to leave in this summer window than not.
Yeah, I think it's and I think it's changed, Don. I think it's changed even in recent weeks because what Paris have become aware of is not just posturing, that he really has set his mind on going. And he's... I think the hierarchy at Paris Saint-Germain are not used to people saying no to them. And they're not used to being in a position where they're forced to do stuff. when we went back a little bit and talked about Real Madrid bidding for him, and we talked about it on here and said there is no amount of money that Real Madrid could offer that would make it worth them selling Kylian Mbappe this summer. What changes that is Mbappe not leaving the door open, is him saying, whatever you do, I am going to go at the end of this season. And all of a sudden, you're looking at, they're in a okay place as far as financial fair play goes, because obviously losses are only taken at 50%. All losses incurred during the pandemic are not attached to your figures at the moment. So they're in a good place as far as FFP goes. But if someone offers you, like say, 200 million, I reckon for it to happen, it will need to get near 200 million euros.
So, euros. Okay.
Well, it's nearly 200 million pounds these days, isn't it? Yeah. I think, because remember, they've got to give 35 million of that to Monaco as well, if they extend him or sell him. That's what they've got to do. And that's why Leonardo was talking about, you know, us making a loss on, you know, we would still owe Monaco money. Mm. It doesn't mean from the original fee, it means in terms of the 35 million sell-on. I think even for PSG, there comes a point where you think, actually, we could do something with that money. You know, that is a not insubstantial amount of money for anyone out there.
They could buy some defensive midfielders or players who will press.
Well, they could, but they won't.
But it is good to have somebody as elegant, always elegant and suave as Leonardo to face the press at a time like this. I thought he did it very, very smoothly when he said, look, obviously Kylian wants to go. We don't want him to go. But okay, he's going to go, but it's going to be on our terms.
But you're right. You're right, Dalton. It was Leonardo as a player, because it was the mix of elegance and brutality, the way he talked about Real Madrid.
But, I do remember him kicking somebody off the pitch.
Tab Ramos.
Tab Ramos in his poor face.
Yeah.
But I think the thing is to know with Leonardo is if someone was going to come out with hard words on this, it was always going to be him, because...
The enforcer.
Because that's him.
Yeah.
But also because the Mbappe situation left him kind of fighting for his job.
Yeah.
Because he was left in charge of, if Mbappe goes, it's down to him, basically. He shouldn't have let it get to this point. Now, we go back to spring, and Al Khelaifi says, right, okay, I'm going to take over the negotiations for this, because you're not getting it done in terms of the contract extension. I mean, to get put in your place like a little boy by the president for that is quite damning. So whereas like the supporters of Leonardo have been saying, well, he's had possibly the greatest transfer summer window ever, getting Donnarumma without paying a fee,
Messi.
Getting Wijnaldum without paying a fee, getting Messi without paying a fee, getting Ashraf Hakimi, all that sort of stuff. How does that stack up if he loses Mbappe?
Also, I mean, for all people go on about these, like, so Wijnaldum, from what I'm told, they basically got him because they offered three times more than what Barcelona were willing to offer him. And this in a COVID-enforced market. And let's not forget the kind of the wider context here, which is basically, as Andy's already kind of referred to, Paris Saint-Germain's owners, who basically the state of Qatar, which gives them, like, I mean, there's no strategy to that. It's basically just, we have a lot of money now when most of football doesn't. I mean, 99% of football doesn't.
And that's why it's so funny, isn't it? Like Real Madrid and Paris Saint-Germain coming up face-to-face like this. Because Paris Saint-Germain are a Galacticos unit as well. Galactique. It's the same thing, isn't it? Because it is about the stars ahead of the plan. Because if you sign Messi, whether you think he's the greatest footballer of all time or not, and of course there's a hugely convincing argument that he is, signing him at this point is not a team builder.
Yeah.
It's something else.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like it's turned out that way, sir.
There's also, just in reference to the two clubs coming up against each other, there's a very strange dynamic with this, which I could never have imagined myself saying about, like, even 6 months ago, where suddenly it's almost bizarrely that little bit better for football that Real Madrid sign a megastar, because it means more of the best talent is spread around. Because I do think it's bad football when, because there is a trend for this now. It feels like COVID has exacerbated this, where there's potentially only five or six clubs at the very top capable of competing, and the Spanish, because of the economics, as we've seen with Barcelona, are being left behind. Now, the flip side to that is it may suddenly mean that Madrid have an advantage again in Spain, just to the point where it seemed like we might have a properly diverse league and like the potential for someone like Sevilla to win. But again, these are all trickle down faults and problems in that regard.
In that respect, actually, it brings me onto the other point. If Mbappe goes to Real Madrid, there will be unforetold consequences all the way down the food chain. You've mentioned one, which is, you know, the sort of existential situation of the Spanish La Liga, but also in terms of football signings, Mbappe goes to Real Madrid, big question mark. Where does Cristiano Ronaldo fit into all of this?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what Jorge Mendes is trying to figure out at the moment, isn't it? At the time we record. From what I'm told, Ronaldo's desperate. I think there's been a lot of reporting from Italy and from England as well, where the preference is basically an English team in the Champions League. Manchester United... they don't really have a space for at the moment, and possibly not the budget, given how much they've spent and the size of their wage bill as they can sell. Liverpool's not going to happen. Chelsea have signed Lukaku, which basically leaves Manchester City.
Oh my word.
I mean, from everyone you talk to, people are saying at the very least, it's possible. I mean, it could be complicated, especially with the nature of Ronaldo's contract and so many commercial connections and all the rest of it. But it at least seems like there's some possibility this could happen by Tuesday. And as obvious, I mean, we've already discussed this a little bit off air, but as obvious as this might seem from so many parties, right down to the fact Manchester City need a goal scorer, I think this has a recipe for a lot of complications.
You know what? I've already said on the ramble, I like it. I think there's a lot to recommend it, particularly short term. And when Miguel was talking about Ronaldo's desperation to leave, and he's been keen to leave for a while, that really suits Juventus as well.
Yeah,
because they want to crawl out from under the rock of his yearly wage. They are in need of a rebuild. They can't do anything with him on the books, and they're in this sort of holding pattern really for the next year. If they can get a deal that gets all his wages off the books, that is fantastic.
But isn't this why it's potentially problematic for City as well going forward? I mean, Ronaldo's almost a contradiction at this point. As brilliant as he still is as a goal scorer, he doesn't actually fit into with modern football. It's been the issue with Juventus where they've tried to kind of introduce a new style, and yet with that style, they're essentially playing with 10 men, and you couldn't have. A greater proponent of this style. I mean, he's basically responsible for its spread throughout the game as Pep Guardiola. Mm. So while City need a goal scorer, and specifically you think someone to finish off so many of those 6-yard cutbacks that have basically become the Guardiola speciality, Guardiola's number 9 is also someone who presses. And I mean, that was the source of so much tension with Sergio Aguero.
Exactly.
And I mean,
yeah.
Is Ronaldo going to do that?
No, he's not going to do that. But I think you go in with your eyes open and realise what you're getting. You're getting a very, very good short-term fix. You're getting the penalty box player that they don't have anywhere else. And, you know, there's a possibility that you take him for a year, you take him for 2 years, and you can still go after Haaland next summer.
Yeah, that's true.
Which I think is quite a seductive way of looking at things.
Yeah.
Certainly for the sort of player he is, committed to the penalty box. If I'm City, as I said on the ramble, I prefer taking him to taking Kane, a player who eats Kevin De Bruyne's space.
So I'm Harry Kane, sitting at home listening to this podcast.
I hope so.
Well, yeah.
It is what it is.
I'm listening to both of you two, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, hang on a second, I'm not going to do the voice. I can't anyway. Hang on a second, what about me? Where do I fit into all of this? You remember what I said about unforetold consequences?
Well, I mean, this is the thing about Kane as well, and explaining some of his desperation, if not necessarily City's, I mean, where you'd wonder about the kind of the exact urge to sign him. Because this summer, the striker market is extremely small. Next summer, it's potentially exploding, especially if Mbappe doesn't go to Madrid now. Mm. And you've got Haaland. And from what we've heard about Haaland, it seems like Raiola has convinced about 5 or 6 clubs that, yeah, we're the number one choice, which could create a few difficulties next summer. But suddenly Kane is maybe at 29 is third or fourth choice on the list, and it's that bit more difficult for him. And you could even argue it's why, for his own future, he needs a 25 goal season more than ever to show people, look, I'm 29, I'm still worth going in for in this market, given like the main competition is two players in the early 20s who represent the future of the game. But yeah, but one thing on Ronaldo, and this does touch on something which again concerns me about the way European football is going, in that we're almost seeing a Super League without a Super League. I mean, we can't have too many illusions about the sentimentality of all this, but ultimately, Ronaldo's a Manchester United legend with, you know, one of their few Ballon d'Or winners, one of their few Champions League winners, core to the mythology of the club. And I think in a normal, even the European market of 10, 15 years ago, I don't think he would have considered Manchester City, because United would have been enough of a kind of a factor that he would look elsewhere. But because of the way the game has gone now, this happened with Messi. It's apparently true with Antonio Conte as well, and his potential options, where if you want to stay at the top and win a Champions League and win the top trophies, there are only about four or five clubs you can go to. So because of that, he suddenly, you know, he's funneled into Manchester City. And it kind of does, it just makes me feel, in terms of the way European football is going, is that it is almost football as content. And like there's no chance to build emotional connections, especially if it means nothing, because players pretty much have to go to your rivals.
Maybe, but I would say part of that, especially with Messi and Ronaldo, is an understanding, and Ronaldo's been in this position for a while, I think, an understanding of his footballing mortality. I think he realises that, you know, he was meant to be the cherry on the cake that took Juventus over the top to the Champions League. Through no fault of anything he's done, they are further away from than ever before. How many more chances have you got? So I think he just has to seize that opportunity. Like, his mum wants him to go back to Sporting, but he's not going to win the Champions League there, is he?
Yeah.
Which is an absolutely huge deal.
But isn't it remarkable in that regard that, like, I mean, the fact that we'd even talk about, say, Arsenal and Milan, two clubs who have been in the Champions League final in the last 15 years, one of them having won it, and yet they would be seen as almost out there romantic choices. And these are huge clubs.
Yes.
Always on the continent. We welcome any questions that you have as well. You can tweet us all at Miguel Delaney, at Andy Brassel, at Dalton Adebayo, or at Football Ramble. And here's a question from Craig Bruce, who says, how in the world can Real Madrid afford to offer €160 million for Mbappe? Is the whole thing one giant bluff before getting him for nothing next year?
I don't think it's a bluff, but I think whether it comes off or not, it is a good way of saying, and that they do aim for it to come off. It's a great way of saying, we're prepared to go all the way for you.
Yeah.
You're our future.
I mean, first of all, you have to accept that everyone will obviously point to what Perez said throughout the Super League, that it doesn't happen, we're finished. That was obviously bullshit, and it was just it was essentially like him, you know, his own attempt to sell it all. But I think they can make the finances work just purely because Mbappe, and there's only the few players this applies to. It's one of those self-perpetuating transfers, and one of those who genuinely does pay for itself because what he represents to the future of Madrid. It's almost like Figo in 2000 again.
Sur l'appui, c'était bien joué avec Giroud.
Oh, Sylvain! Oh, Sylvain, il l'a vu! Oui. Kylian Mbappé! Ouais. Kylian Mbappé, il l'a vu! Ça fait 4 et ça fait peut-être un quart de finale pour l'équipe de France. 68e minute!
Let's turn our attentions now to Serie A, and there is one obvious highlight there at the beginning of this season, who is Jose Mourinho, etc. Have they learned to sing that yet?
I thought you were going to do the other Jose Mourinho song for a minute.
I wasn't brought up that way, but thank you for the offer.
When I was on the Madrid Metro for the 2010 Champions League final, the one the Inter fans were singing was the tune of what's the fuck? Yeah, I love you, baby. That was Jose Mourinho. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. That's not a bad one, actually. Nice twist on it. Whichever way they're going to do it, they'll be in fine song at the moment, Andy, because he kicked off his Serie A tenure with a bang against Fiorentina.
It was so entertaining as well. What I found remarkable about that is we spoke about it with Nicky last week. The idea that the Italian football landscape felt that it was receiving 2010 Mourinho. Jesus. The level of excitement.
But whereas everyone seduces themselves into that, though.
Yeah, yeah, it can happen. It can happen. But there was a feeling that they were receiving a very different Mourinho to the one that Spurs were sending away. But quite a tempestuous pre-season, as we talked about beforehand. And then, with fans back in the Stadio Olimpico, new centre-forward Tammy Abraham, who had an absolutely massive influence.
Brilliant, he was good.
And, you know, it was great to watch. They were really great to watch. And I came away with that the feeling that Roma are going to be good to watch this season. I mean, isn't that a remarkable thing to think about a Mourinho side? Already two of his signings making a huge impact. When you look at Abraham, as we said, he was replaced by Eldor Shomurodov, who the Uzbek, who's come from Genoa, came on. He created the third goal for Jordan Veretout after Abraham set up the first two. Nicola Zaniolo, who I believe we've got a question about, he's back and fit and a little bit too keen. And then the first goal to start it all off was Henrik Mkhitaryan, who was the source of so much tension at Manchester United. I came away from that and thinking, well, Roma ain't going to win the league in a million years. Top four, I'm still not convinced. I think that would be, given what Roma have been through over the last few years, I don't want to go back to his famous quote about Manchester United finishing second being the same as a trophy. I honestly think if Roma were to make top four this season, that would be a more than acceptable result for Mourinho. But if they made top four and had some fun along the way, that would be an absolute revelation, I think.
It's always like this, though. I mean, genuinely, like, there's always the honeymoon period. It's like United in 2016-17, the same.
Spurs going Spurs, top.
I was there at his first game with Spurs where they beat West Ham. I think it was a 4-2. Dele Alli was unbelievable that day. Had that little flick behind. And I said, wow, this is so open. It's always the same. And this was, of course, after his year sabbatical after Manchester United, where he talked about how, I've been updating my methods and all this. And we saw a reversion to the same thing. So I'm not going to buy it. But what I am interested in Mourinho more so, and I do think there is... I absolutely would bet against Roma finishing top four. I think his methods can still be effective to a very certain degree. What I am fascinated by is how his football principles fit into this particular Serie A, especially as a...
Yes. It's changed a lot in 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. And the kind of the little tension, or not tensions, but the kind of the tactical clashes that develop through that. And what is a much more, much more open Serie A in terms of kind of the way the game, that we could see the Italian national team in the Euros being the kind of the ultimate example of that. Almost a distillation of what Serie A is becoming.
Interesting, because I tend to agree with you about Jose Mourinho, by the way, that he will revert to type. But Serie A, you would have thought this season would have had that Euros as something of a springboard. But there's still a question mark over it.
From anyone you talk to in kind of like in coaching circles or player development, and I wrote a piece in this during the Euros, like Serie A is maybe it's the next place where the next great football leap will happen. Where so, like in 2010, in 2008, 2009, it was Spain, particularly the national team and Guardiola's pressing. And then it was 5 years on from that, it was basically German interpretation of pressing. And that's pretty much what dominates the game now. Yet, a lot of people in the game basically point to Italy as the next maybe great leap. And it's going to be about how players are no longer coached to specific positions anymore. You could say to a degree Spinazzola typified that at the Euros, and it's a pity he's out for so long.
A real shame, yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting if we are going to see this kind of new spin on universality and if the way Italy develops in that way, how Mourinho, who does have such a kind of fixed approach, adapts to that. And who knows? Maybe it could be one of those things as well where his football is so distinctive now that it actually has... The kind of and it can be effective in its own way.
But it's an interesting idea, isn't it? That idea of players taking responsibility and just stepping out of that framework and doing what they can do. I feel that's quite a big part of Italy under Mancini, actually. Because I don't know about you, but going through Mancini's coaching career, and clearly his desire for the job is something, as we talked about before, that is something that has made his spell at Italy totally. Because, you know, he would have walked over hot coals back from St. Petersburg to take that job. And, you know, you can feel his implication in it. But there is the sense that he gives players that platform to express themselves. Now, the idea that maybe Mourinho is a little bit more hands-off, it's quite interesting. I mean, there were so many bits in that, not just Abraham, who was having an amazing time. You know, he got Drongovsky, the goalkeeper, sent off as well by dribbling round him. You know, he was involved in everything in the hour that he was
on.
I
thought he played better for Roma. I know it's only the opening game, nevertheless, I think he played better for Roma than I'd seen him play for Chelsea.
He felt a bit freer, didn't he?
Yeah, he was bullying everybody all over the place. He looked unmanageable for a defender.
And there was this headline in the Gazzetta dello Sport the following day, and it said, "It's already Abraham's Roma."
Oh, well.
And that must have been a wonderful feeling for him. Mm. But the thing that really struck me, actually, just before that, I think before he got Drongovsky sent off, I think it was a long crossfield pass where I think it would have been Pellegrini. He didn't quite hit it right. And Rick Karsdorp, who came over from Feyenoord with a reputation of someone who could build into becoming a really good fullback, who could be that kind of opposite player to Spinazzola on the other side, he shouldn't have been able to get the pass. And, you know, he's been through some terrible injuries, Karsdorp, and he's got himself in a good place now. He just stretched out this, like, Inspector Gadget leg and, like, kept it in. You thought, oh, my God, they're keen. And, you know, you look at Zaniolo. Actually, we've got a question about Zaniolo here from Marco Serial on Twitter. How good is Zaniolo? Is he in the De Rossi role after that red card? Well, like I said, he's come back from two cruciate knee ligament injuries almost successively. He's put on a bit of muscle. I get the impression he can do more in... Mourinho wants him to do more in central areas, maybe. But it's clear that he was someone who was just so psyched for it. I mean, I thought the second yellow card was super soft and he was really unlucky. But that sense that he wanted to be involved maybe took him a little bit over the line. But he, again, is a player given a bit of license who can take your team onto the next level. And there tend to be, I think, quite a lot of those sort of players in Mourinho's team. Like the idea, like Shomurodov is another one. Abraham, we talked about that sense of freedom. If they can retain that, you know, if you can have a traditional Mourinho structure, but he was to give a bit more responsibility to the players and say, you interpret it for me. He's got the sort of players who can really do that. So I think that could maybe make a difference for them. I'm being optimistic for the moment, obviously, but I think it's a noted difference from some of the other squads he's coming. I mean, Mkhitaryan's one of those players.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just in relation to Abraham as well, only the other day I was talking to someone around Chelsea. They feel he was basically unfortunate in that Tuchel just basically didn't fancy him. Because I think that the move from pretty much everyone around Chelsea is, okay, he's not Lukaku level, obviously. He's maybe not quite an elite forward. But in a team like that, he could if he got a regular run at Chelsea, he'd get 20 goals.
Which is not to be sniffed at.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think it's fascinating hearing how the philosophy of Mancini during the Euros could still influence Serie A, and also where Jose Mourinho or anybody else who doesn't quite fit into that, where how their season will pan out. The interesting thing about, just going back to the Euros, one of the interesting things about the Italy team is that they were almost or mostly home-based players. It has to have an effect, doesn't it, on the way that
I think that's why maybe Mancini, rather than influencing Serie A, it was more an end product of, a product of which way Serie A has been heading,
yeah,
and what you can do with the. And I mean, because I suppose since about 2012, 2014, Italy has basically completely changed its production methods to essentially. Its main product is these kind of, you know, technically adept midfielders in a way that they had been missing, and why they fell behind in the 2000s.
And it's interesting because whereas the push for that in Germany, the push for changing the type of player you produce came from the shortfall of the national team.
Yeah.
In Italy, It's not that at all, because they won the 2006 World Cup. It's post-Calciopoli and how that financially affected the league and how that affected the prestige of the league. The league had to reinvent itself because there was a bit of a talent drain.
Yeah, yeah.
And something had to come in to fill the gap, and the football had to change, I think, to make Serie A popular all over the world again.
And there's a really interesting thing there in that in Germany, from they're actually right now undergoing a kind of, not quite an overhaul, but they're studying what they can do because they feel the players are producing have slipped behind a little bit in terms of what they're doing. In Spain, there's a similar debate that Luis Enrique has been so on, where I mean, I think in Spain, it's not so much the production of players who are still, like there's still an immense production line. It's more kind of the style the teams play and this kind of this passive possession, but there's a discussion there. Whereas Italy, okay, they're producing these technically adept kind of almost universalists, but there is something a bit more, they've got more of an edge, more of a kind of, I suppose, there's a greater intensity about them, it feels. And it, again, which points to this being a next step of player potentially.
Non l'ha potuto Buffon, nono gol in campionato, 224 gol, Nord alla d'un passo, il capitano, braccio al cielo, tutti I giocatori su di lui.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Remember. Andy, why are you smiling? I'm just trying to think of how many of the fans watching PSV versus Benfica must have been thinking, remember 1988 and what was then known as the European Cup final, where it ended on a penalty shootout that never seemed to end. So there are echoes of that when PSV and Benfica meet again in this year's Champions League in the early stages.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, when you think of how much European football's changed when you have these two mega clubs, certainly historically, who both have good teams at the moment, I would say, fighting for just a place in the group stage. It's something's changed. I mean, to summarise the game or the tie, it was a really good tie, I thought, between two really good teams. Benfica won the first leg 2-1 in Lisbon last week. They were a little bit fortunate too. Odysseas Flakodimos, their goalkeeper, who they've been trying to sell, actually, was brilliant in both of these games. He saved them again in the second leg. Benfica played an hour with 10 men after not just a defender, but their best defender, Lucas Verissimo, who I think will get a move to somewhere really big next year. He was sent off for a second booking. And Vlachodimos had some great moments. Aaron Jahavi missed a really, really good chance from close in. But on the whole, PSV didn't create as much as they should have, especially for a team that's attacking as them. But you could see the looks on their faces at the end. And, you know, I think it is something that's really hard to get over, going out of the Champions League at the playoff stage, because it feels like your season has been flattened in August. You looked at the reaction of the Monaco players when they went out after extra time. They were quite unlucky to Shakhtar last night as well. And they're going to find it hard to get over. And PSV have had such a positive dynamic to their start to the season. They thrashed Ajax 4-0 in the Johan Cruyff Shell, the Super Cup that's named after Johan Cruyff. And I think it is hard to get over. For Benfica, it's an enormous boost. But I was left with the feeling, I felt quite a sadness that both of them aren't in the group stage.
Yeah, completely. And again, you know, it comes back to something we've discussed in this show so much, not least today, in the lack of diversity in European football and kind of the almost the homogenization of the Champions League in that regard. But the very fact that there are so few fixed places for those outside the very top leagues points that issue and why they're in this game in the first place. And you're right, actually, in the sense that it's a curious dynamic as well to have a game that basically that defines your season.
That you're not ready for.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, these are sort of matches that should, like, given the stakes involved, should actually be teams build up to
a season pinnacle.
Yeah, exactly. And yet you have it right at the start when you're finding your feet. It's only what, 4 weeks? Well, five or 6 weeks since the end of the Euros. Mm. You know, it's so odd in that regard.
There is so much to talk about as the beginning of the Champions League always. And arguably, the way that the league is now is a result of the days when just anybody could get into the group stages. And then Silvio Berlusconi came in and said, no, let's make it the more important teams being in the group stages. And that skewered the whole sort of European football ethos quite a lot. Now that you have the situation where those old timers are not in the final stages, we're sort of complaining, but they're not the main thrust.
There's a classic.
They're not the main thrust of European football. So do we really want to see PSV Eindhoven and even Benfica in the Champions League?
But that's precisely the issue though, right? Okay. These clubs, despite their great names, maybe aren't attractive to the casual football fan because they don't have the best talent. But that's because the best talent, it can only be afforded by the absolute top clubs who are an increasingly narrow band. But football has almost consciously created this situation through every single rule that's been passed in the last 30 years, the lack of regulation. And it's almost like this kind of chicken and egg cycle where the major Western European clubs, they're already attractive because of the way particularly prize money in the Champions League itself is funneled. They get more money, which means they've got better players, which means they get more media interest, which means they get more money, which means they get better players, and everyone else is left behind. There's always the danger that we romanticize. I mean, for me anyway, romanticizing kind of what football or our life was like when we were in our teens. But it's impossible not to think that European football was better when, and like this comes back to what we're saying about Milan and Arsenal being left behind, say, in the pursuit of someone like Ronaldo or Messi or whatever. But that European football was better when there was a better spread of money. So basically more, as you would call it, unfashionable teams. They couldn't just go far, but they could actually be exciting teams in their own right. And wow, like that used to be the glory about European football. A team you didn't necessarily know much about or wouldn't necessarily have much of a history. Take Nantes in the 90s, where you have a team, what, with Ndoram, with Makalel. Mm. The classic example, Dynamo Kiev in 99.
Yeah.
That's just impossible now. And these weren't just kind of like unfashionable sides doing well. They were like, they were exciting. This is like teams we admire and the way people look to the super clubs now.
This isn't really about minnow clubs though. It's about minnow leagues.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing, the reduced status of the Portuguese and the Dutch league. Because, you know, we were talking about this earlier, weren't we, Miguel? The fact that Mario Götze, who's had a really good start to the season with PSV Eindhoven, looks like he could be on for a recall to the Germany squad. Xhavi was earning like an incredible amount in China, so they've paid him a bit to come back. There's no doubt about that. They even signed this the day after they went out of the Champions League. to Benfica. PSV signed an extended contract with Noni Madueke, who's been linked with moves to Dortmund and various Premier League clubs, having come through to the Tottenham Academy in the first place. And, you know, he's kind of a, I guess, junior Jadon Sancho in that sense. I sense he'll be back in the Premier League at some point and do very well. He had a great start to this season. You look at Benfica, they spent 80 million on transfers last summer. Not this summer, because they came third after spending 80 million on transfers. So we're not talking about little clubs or even really tiny budgets. We're talking about the fact that those leagues have been whittled down and down in importance. And now even the biggest clubs in those leagues, I mean, Benfica are a huge European name, are in a situation where it's really hard work. I know there'll be Celtic fans listening to this and Rangers fans going, we are hearing you.
Yeah.
But it's tough.
Well, it is why, I mean, as a traditionalist in that sense, I would always been against kind of the breakup of football's old structures. But I think it's why there has, and for a long time now, been such a solid argument for basically multinational quote domestic leagues, in the sense of
Atlantic League, or whatever.
Because from a very basic logistics, because this is what it ultimately comes down to, it gives these clubs and these countries much greater TV markets, which gives them much better money and creates more parity across European football. Suddenly, a Celtic or a Benfica or even clubs below them can be much bigger fish because they're in a bigger pond.
Yeah, you say that. Although the Belgians and the Dutch didn't agree to come together as the Benelux League or whatever it was, did they? And
Could happen.
Do you reckon it still could?
Yeah. Okay. It's on the table. And it is, as Miguel says, because of TV rights and because of the time at which the domestic TV contracts in those two countries expire.
And even like UEFA would have been traditionally against such ideas, but there is a realization at UEFA level, and this can be seen in the Champions League, that as the pool of competitive clubs in the Champions League narrows, something needs to be done, and one of the best, almost workable solutions is this.
There must be Celtic and Rangers fans thinking, yeah, bring on an English Scottish league. We'll wipe the floor with you.
Well, I mean, England would always be resistant to that, just because, I mean, and this is the problem, that the Premier League now is so powerful, so internationally powerful.
Doesn't need the rest, does
it? Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I was thinking about this actually in relation to even how Ronaldo wants to go to pretty much exclusively an English club. The whole idea of kind of rise and fall league. So we've seen it with now Serie A at the start of this century. We can see it in real time with Spain now. Mm. Is it even possible for England to fall to the same factor? Because it feels so fixed now as to kind of, and especially given what's happened with COVID, and it feels so fixed at the global TV league. And it's such a challenge for everyone else to kind of challenge that.
It is.
There is a tweet here from Jack who says, not necessarily in your wheelhouse, but can you explain what's happened to Basel over the last few years? I know it's Basel or Basel, whatever. They've gone from perennial title winners to a distant second at best to young boys. How has this happened?
Mainly through a change in ownership, which has led to a scale down of the sort of funding that they had. And on the other hand, young boys have taken that opportunity brilliantly. You look at the distances by which they've won the Swiss Super League over the last couple of years, over a couple of different coaches. Adi Hütter, who went to Frankfurt and now at Borussia Mönchengladbach, started that off. And he also embedded a very, very exciting attacking football there as well. Look at Gerardo Seoane, who's also made his way to the Bundesliga. He's just started at Bayer Leverkusen this season. They've started the campaign very promisingly. He carried that good work on. And now David Wagner's there, of course, and he's got them back in the Champions League. And I think it does go back to Champions League money, because especially in a league of that sort of level, if you're coining Champions League group stage money, it gives you such an advantage. Not like young boys have gone out and done anything particularly lavish, but in terms of holding on to players for an extra year or so. And that was something, if you go back 5 or 6 or even 7 years, or even 15 actually, when they were really doing well in Europe, that is something that Basel were able to do that you didn't expect them to do. Hold on to that Mo Salah for an extra year or something. And that was an absolutely massive difference to them, or Manuel Akanji or someone like that. Whereas now, young boys are maybe in the spot that they can do that as well, although they have relied a little bit more on that sort of upper mid-range talent that, you know, horses for courses that can get you to a certain point. I mean, you look at Guillaume Waraud, who's still in Swiss football, but is getting on a bit. So left for Sion a while back. He did some incredible stuff for young boys when he came back from China. And someone like that, who basically no one's going to come and buy, but can help you get to a really good point. And they've worked the market really well, and they've had a solid philosophy of playing. Where at Basel, there's been a lot of unrest behind the scenes. Obviously, it's something that happens when you've had a dynasty for a long time and it starts to fall apart. To bring some calm to the situation is really, really difficult. I mean, some people attacked the club offices last year. There was a pig's head left outside. It was pretty nasty. So really, they've just got to find a way to try and bridge that gap. But I think it might take a while, especially with young boys attracting a coach like Wagner and making the group stage again.
Just on that, actually, almost tying everything together with today, it's probably never been a greater argument for, even for one season, suspending Champions League prize money and using that as a solidarity fund for all of European football. I mean, because at a stroke, you're actually solving a lot of issues. Mm. They're still going to be there, but it suddenly softens a lot of challenges.
Unfortunately, though, the Champions League is a little bit like Gossip Girl, in like the biggest pupils run the show.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is from Zagadone, to tweet, which says, at Clermont Foot, can they sustain this early season momentum, and any interesting stories about their rise to Ligue 1, Clermont?
Well, they're having their first ever season in the top flight, which is fantastic. Really good start for them. 7 points from the first two games. They came back from 3-1 down in the last 10 minutes to get themselves a draw at Lyon at the weekend. So it's an incredible start for them. And considering they've never been in Ligue 1 before, it's quite an effort. They're well coached. What they've done well so far is, although I don't know if they're going to manage to keep him beyond the end of August, they kept the top scorer from last season, Mohamed Bayo, who looked like he was going to Bordeaux, didn't. Score against Bordeaux in the opening game of the season, obviously. I mean, he's been carrying an injury, but he's still been playing very well in these opening games, three in the first two games, and he could have had more with the sort of chances he's got. He is going to cause a lot of problems for some good teams this season. So if they can manage to hold on to him, that is a biggie. But people are starting to take them seriously, because what I like so much about them, we talked about the way that football has evolved in Italy, for example. What I've really enjoyed in the opening weeks of this Ligue 1 season is that smaller teams are not afraid to attack. You look at the way Troyes and Strasbourg and Brest last weekend have had a go at PSG. They haven't won in the end, but you know, they've taken their free hit and had a proper good go at it. And Clermont are doing exactly the same, and long may it continue.
One more tweet from Andrew, who asks both of you, best kit in Europe this season so far. Fancy going first?
you're completely, I mean, I just find myself, I'm going to completely ruin the question, but I just find myself increasingly disappointed by all modern kits, basically.
Look, you can say Milan third if you like. No one's going to judge you.
Is that one of the Puma ones?
Yeah.
They're just, I mean, this is also a problem because I feel it comes from this whole obviously new thing where they change the kit every year, which means they're almost running out of designs. So they always have to do something differently. But I just like a plain kit. I like it.
This year's Ajax one is amazing.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
If you're talking about classic, that's pretty good, isn't it?
Although I was apparently one reason they do these more elaborate designs is because counterfeiters are getting so good. But again, even with that, like you can make a nice plain kit with a kind of nice woven design in. Like that's where they're kind of different. Rather than these kind of horrendous colours or patterns, I think most modern kits are shit.
Although talking of, you know, there is a place for a horrendous colour designs. I mean, Leon Fourth, I cannot confirm or deny whether I've got one of those to play right, football okay. in this year. But one I really do like, actually, talking of tradition, is they premiered it last season, the Dortmund fourth, which looks like the ones they were wearing, the reverse ones are the ones they were wearing in the season that they won the Champions League in 96-97. I mean, retro is always good, right? It's even got blocky numbers. It's brilliant.
And you can tweet us at any time at Miguel Delaney, at Andy Brassel, at Dotson Adebayo, and at Football Ramble. I think we've just got time for you to recommend each a football match of the week for us, game of the week end at least.
I'll go with Barcelona Getafe purely because I am I am fascinated just by how the kind of whole structural dynamic of how Barca continue to adapt to the post-Messi world. I mean, the first game is always a bit of a strange one because there's almost this adrenaline thing about it. But I think it's more interesting the more it starts to settle and they realise they don't have potentially the greatest player in history to bail them out.
Are you saying Memphis isn't the greatest player in history?
I mean, okay.
Again,
maybe outside the top 30.
I might try and wedge this in every week. Well, I know, speaking of what Miguel was on, we're all going to be watching Reims versus PSG on Sunday night for Messi's debut. I think that's pretty clear anyway, so I don't need to tell you to watch that or even to pour yourself a nice glass of champagne for it. But I'm going to go Sunday afternoon, 4:30, Wolfsburg versus RB Leipzig. Difficult start for Wolfsburg under Mark van Bommel, but they were pretty good last week at Hertha Berlin. And Lucas Emcha, who's come from Manchester City, got the winner in that one, which was good for them. They've also got a new striker in Luka Waldschmidt, who they bought from Benfica. And Leipzig, well, now that Dominic Szoboszlai is fit and ready to go, scored two goals last week in his first start against Stuttgart, plus Andre Silva got off the mark. I think there's goals in this.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this yeah. shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was saying something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good for something, you know. and on my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.